Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, if you've been thinking about checking out that new local restaurant or catching a movie in the theater, you might also ask yourself who to go with. And the best answer might be yourself. Our next guest found a lot of value in going on a regular self-date and has written about the benefits of doing things in public by ourselves and embracing solitude. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do this? Do you set aside time to go out and do things alone? Where do you like to go by yourself? Do you feel weird, as I do, maybe eating at a restaurant by yourself? Nobody's judging you, but does it feel weird? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Faith Hill is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. She's been writing about the value of solitude in a few pieces lately. Her latest is called Take Yourself on a Date. Faith, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you've been on the solitude beat lately, the piece I just mentioned. You wrote about the value of time alone for kids, about people who are nocturnal because they enjoy being by themselves. What got you interested in why people choose to spend time alone?
Yeah, well, I really love my time alone, and socializing can really drain me. But at the same time, I feel like my relationships are extremely important to me. I want to tend to them. I care about them. So just personally, the balance between solitude and social connection is something I think about a lot. I'm sort of always looking for this perfect in-between. And I think for a lot of people, it's complicated. It's hard to figure out how much alone time you should carve out for yourself, particularly because I think alone time isn't really valued like social time is. So, you know, you hear a lot about the need for connection and community, but I was sort of interested in the flip side to that.
And off the top, I want to distinguish between loneliness and solitude. Could you spell out the difference there a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of times people sort of think of the difference in terms of quantity, that, you know, you want some time alone, but not too much. And when you have too much, it's loneliness. And there's some truth to that. You know, I think different people need different amounts of alone time, but you don't probably want to have too much. But another thing that matters is quality. So a lot of it is really in sort of how you're looking at your alone time, how you're approaching it, and sort of, you know, the attitude that you come at it with. So I think for a lot of people, even if they didn't choose to have alone time, it can really help to sort of think of it as an opportunity.
And the intentionality is something that you are really focused on, I think, as opposed to, oh, I got, you know, an hour or two by myself. What am I going to do? Read a book, this or that. You really want this to be premeditated. And that's something you've been working on yourself. Why is that important?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for a long time, I even though I thought of myself as someone who liked alone time, I did not think of like doing an activity with it or making it any kind of special ritual. It was just sort of when I was able to get it, pockets in between things. But, you know, I think that you sort of look at your alone time differently if you make a ritual out of it. And a lot of times we don't think about solitude that way. You know, we think of it either as like a productive time or just empty time. But we don't think of it as like the time that we reserve for fun things. So I kind of wanted to focus on just like that ability to really do whatever you would want to do, but do it by yourself. And that can include, you know, being in public, being in the world, doing what you love.
And that's what you've chosen to do with a lot of your intentional, your planned solitude is do things in public. Why is that important to you to be going out and doing a museum or a dinner or whatever it might be?
Yeah, I think there's something special about being alone around other people and just in the world, you know, maybe experiencing art or food, smelling smells and hearing music and voices. It sort of makes you remember that you're like, you know, you don't exist outside of the world. You're sort of part of this vast symphony of human experience. But at the same time, you know, you still get to sort of listen to your own thoughts and you don't have to always be responding to someone else. I think, you know, when you're socializing, you don't always even fully appreciate the sort of like sensory experience going on around you, ironically enough, because you're sort of wrapped up in conversation or discussing what to do next. So it can actually be a way to really connect with the world and be sort of present in space and, you know, seeing people and listening.
That sounds cool. But I'm also, as you're talking, I'm thinking there's almost like a cliche scene in movies and TV shows where our protagonist shows up at the restaurant by themselves and the maitre d' or waiter or whatever is like, will sir be dining alone today, with a bit of pity. And it's like this sad sort of pathetic thing. How do we overcome that mindset?
It's a good question. I think in America, at least, we really value extroversion and social connection. And, you know, there's research about how people sort of assume that if they're out doing something enjoyable in public, like they assume people will think that they are lonely or friendless. But, you know, some of that research also shows that, like, people overestimate the degree to which they'll seem lonely. So I think, you know, partly it's real, but partly it's in our heads and we kind of let ourselves worry about it too much. And I think probably if you go out and do something, you might be, you know, surprised if you knew what people were thinking about, that they're more concerned about themselves. But I also think there's sort of different levels to it. So, you know, I can totally understand being nervous to go to a crowded restaurant by yourself. And I think it's awesome if people do, but you don't need to do any one thing. So I kind of liked going to movies alone for that reason, because I get to sort of be, you know, around strangers, but also like in the dark, and I don't feel so in the spotlight. So, you know, I think part of the beauty of the self-date is really you choosing what you want to do. And there's a lot of different options. You know, you could go for a walk, you could be in the park, and some of them might feel a little bit more comfortable.
Talking to Faith Hill, senior associate editor at The Atlantic, about the value of solitude and going out and doing things on our own and making a plan, being intentional about it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do some version of this? Say, I'm going to plan for some time to go out and do, well, do what? Tell us about it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ellen is with us in Wausau. Ellen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
So my comment is that I don't mind eating out by myself in a restaurant, and I often enjoy it. But 9 times out of 10, when I walk in and say table for one, the response I get is just one.
Oh, no. Well, do you find a different restaurant the next time then, Ellen?
I have. Stop going to restaurants who give me really lousy tables, like a table back by the bathroom.
Oh, but you don't mind, you like it's them that are creating the problem here. Once you're there, you're fine eating by yourself.
Yes, definitely. But that's I get a negative response when people say just one.
Oh no! All right. Well, Ellen, well, if you've served Ellen in that way, cut it out. Be nice to Ellen when she shows up at your restaurant. Faith, there it is. I mean, I'll say when I'm at a restaurant eating by myself, I feel weird about it. If I see somebody else eating by themselves, I don't even think about it. Why? I don't know. Why do some people anyway feel like we're judged or judging someone eating by themselves, like Ellen?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I do think, you know, there's can kind of be a mismatch there between how weird we feel and how we view other people. But I think it's a good point, too, that it is partly like a bigger structural problem that, you know, we look at aloneness in this way. And it's, you know, easier said than done to just be like, go eat at a restaurant alone. Like some people are, you know, might make you feel weird about it. But in case it helps, one thing that I have found is really helpful is if I take a book, I feel like I can always have it in case I want to pull it out if I'm feeling weird, but I'm still, you know, having my own solo experience.
I have used the book shield before myself. Ellen, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Faith Hill, senior associate editor at The Atlantic, about the upside of doing things alone. Her latest piece is called Take Yourself on a Date, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do this sort of thing? Take yourself out to dinner, movie, museum, hike, whatever. Does it feel weird when people see you doing something alone, or does it not? Do you not care what people think, even if they do look at you funny? Call 800-642-1234. Do you find a lot of value in solitude? Or, I don't know, does being up in your own head sometimes get a little much? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Faith Hill from The Atlantic, talking about why it can be good to do things by yourself out in public. Make time to do some solitary activities. We can get a lot out of it, she says. Join in at 800-642-1234. If you have examples of this kind of thing in your own life, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. Happy holidays. This is a fun topic for me. I vacation by myself. I get excited because I always meet new people when I go wherever I go. But I have a New Yorker cartoon idea on this topic.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, if you put a sweet potato on a park bench, the caption would read, "I am what I am."
Jeff, thanks a lot. A vacation by himself of Faith. That's taking this even a step further.
Yes, it is. But apparently it's, you know, a lot of people feel the same. Rates of solo travel are way up, and a lot of people are doing it in 2022, which I think is great. And for my piece, I did talk to a travel coach who sort of, you know, told me that she has really been seeing this firsthand. And from talking to some of her clients, they've really been starting to feel like, you know, maybe they don't need to wait around for other people to take that trip they really want to take. So, you know, fingers crossed, maybe people are getting more comfortable with doing things by themselves. But I think solo travel is a really cool way of looking at that. So much you can experience, and so many people who are like dying to go places, but trying to coordinate with someone else. So it's great.
Jeff, happy solo travels. Kurt joins us now in Elgin, Illinois. Kurt, hi.
Yeah, hi. I was piggyback on what was just said, but I had something else to say. I've just retired, and I'm very much looking forward to, I've learned to look forward to, trips that I would take by myself to all those places I would go to with other people, and I'm looking forward to that. And what I mentioned is I'm very happy being with myself and by myself in places, but I feel sad, I'll have to say, when I see other people who are just sitting by themselves, kind of like that Nighthawks, when you look at the whoever Edward Hopper's Nighthawks thing,
sure,
looking through that window. I feel sad about that, but I never feel that same for myself. I feel like I almost feel like I want to get into that mode when I can just be.
I love
it. Myself.
Kurt, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, you, Faith, talked to a psychologist about that. There can be better or worse ways to be in our heads when we're doing this solitude stuff. What did you learn?
Yeah, it's so true. So I talked to this psychologist, Ethan Cross, about this. He wrote a book called Chatter, and it's about this kind of self-talk, as it's called. It's basically the internal conversation going on in your head. And he has found that self-talk can really help with introspection, but you have to do it in the right way, or else you can really sort of go down a rabbit hole of rumination. So, you know, one thing that can help with that is shifting the perspective that you use to talk to yourself. So literally like using the second or third person rather than the first, and instead of saying, you know, I should do something, you'd say you should, or, you know, she should. So the idea is that because you're usually nicer to other people than to yourself, you're kind of treating yourself as another person. So, you know, it might sound silly, but I think when you're out alone by yourself, it can be useful to think of it as sort of a similar principle where, you know, you're not just doing something yourself, but you're really taking yourself out to do something. You know, it's almost chivalrous, and you're sort of getting to know yourself. So it's so true that there are sort of better and worse ways, and some people can sort of feel lonely if they are like very much, you know, wrapped up in their own head and feeling like just stuck within that rather than kind of in the world and having that distance.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Sue with us in Appleton. Sue, hi, what did you want to tell us about?
Hi, I wanted to talk about traveling and negotiating the world as a single woman. I go camping alone, long distance camping. I put on over 10,000 miles last year, and
wow,
I'll be leaving in January to do it again. And I'm a member of lots of women camper groups, and we discuss safety a lot. that we don't, some of us don't want our van to be, or our vehicles, campers, to be identified as a woman is in there. So there are various techniques and tips that women use to, as decoys. So people might think there's a second person or a man with us when we're camping. But there are a lot of women doing this who are not necessarily single. We just love that we don't have to negotiate where we'll go, when we'll go, should we stop, should we change directions. It's just so much freedom. Just love it.
Sue, thank you so much for sharing the joys of it and the safety concerns. Faith, what do you think about Sue's experience?
Yeah, it's a really, really good point. And I think it's so true that, you know, some people really have to think about safety when they're thinking about being alone. And there are limits to, you know, just doing whatever you want to do out by yourself. But I love the idea of kind of doing it as a group, but still, you know, I think there are still chances for solitude within that. That's such a good point. And when I talked to that travel coach, she mentioned that she will sometimes talk to clients who are worried either about safety or just, you know, getting lonely, wanting to make sure they'll have the opportunity to be around people if they want to, even though they do want time to themselves. And she recommends walking groups. So it's sort of a similar idea of like, you know, you don't necessarily need to be talking all the time. It might be different than like going just with a partner or best friend. You're really expected to sort of be chatting constantly or, you know, just really spending your time together, but you can kind of be with people, but, you know, then also be in your head when you want to be. And I think that is sort of it's a beautiful part about that kind of solo travel and the self-date is that you know, you have some control over that and you can kind of get both.
Thanks a lot for that call. Michael joins us now in Kaukauna. Michael, hello.
Oh, have been a field service technician for a big part of my career, and that involves being away from home and kind of into a forced doing things by your own. You kind of just learn to get used to it and you learn to kind of enjoy it. One of the little tricks that I would always do is I would eat places where you could eat at the bar, because then you wouldn't be taking up a whole table for a group, and then people more open to that. So that's just one of the things I learned. You just kind of learn to roll with it. You have to enjoy it and look at the different tips you can to make it easier for the staff for the restaurant that you're at.
Michael, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Faith, Michael didn't necessarily choose to be alone. The job put him there, but he made the most of it.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring this up because it really is, you know, it's kind of a documented thing that I talked to some researchers about when I was writing this piece, is that, you know, I sort of suspected, like thinking about pandemic isolation, like that if people were forced into some alone time, they would automatically not like it because they didn't feel they'd chosen it. But what I learned is actually that even, you know, when some people sort of found themselves having to be alone, it still sort of mattered how they, you know, then looked at the alone time. And there, you know, were a lot of people who I think found, you know, even through all the many difficult parts, that they liked some of that solitude more than they thought they would. So it really can change everything, sort of how you think about the alone time, even if it's, you know, you kind of find yourself with it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Faith, I wanted to take a couple minutes on another piece you wrote about kids and solitude. And, you know, we often hear about overscheduling, overbooking kids. How important is some alone time, some solitude for kids?
Yeah, it can be really important. You know, of course, kids, like, you know, most people, it's good to have some socializing. So it's not that they should, you know, have too much alone time. But I think people really don't think about kids needing any alone time at all. And it turns out there's some really important psychological benefits. You know, younger kids can kind of learn how to work out big emotions. Teenagers certainly use it for sort of reflection and thinking about their identity and who they are apart from their family unit and their friends. So I think it is really important for, you know, parents to sort of keep that in mind and ask their kid whether they, you know, feel like they have enough alone time, or, you know, they might want to cut back activities.
Now, getting back to the grownups here at Faith, suppose somebody's listening and thinking, okay, yeah, this sounds pretty good. And I never do this sort of thing, like never make a plan to take myself out and do whatever. Can you offer some encouragement, maybe some first steps for them to give it a shot?
Yeah. So, you know, I think like sort of crucial part of the self-date is that it is whatever you want it to be. So you shouldn't feel like, you know, you have to go out for 3 hours and eat at a restaurant alone. It's, you know, like the whole point of it is that it's tailored to you and what you want to do. So you can really, you know, dip your toe in. You could do something alone at home, but, you know, really make it feel special and sort of set that time aside and think of it as an opportunity that you want to celebrate. Or, you know, you could go out for a little bit and, you know, make it a shorter trip or always let yourself come home. So, you know, one researcher told me there are sort of like different rooms of solitude that you can enjoy. And, you know, one room might be total solitude and the other might be sort of a little bit of solitude, but you're around people and they can all serve different purposes. So I would just say it's, you know, maybe not useful always to be like a solitude purist. You know, it's really important, but it also is, you know, it's different for different people.
Faith, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Faith Hill, Associate Senior Editor at The Atlantic. We talked to her about the benefits of doing things by ourselves and her latest piece called Take Yourself on a Date. You can find a link to that at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you do this, if you take yourself on a date, if you enjoy those planned moments or hours of solitude doing whatever it is you want to do, love to hear about it. You can tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now let's set the scene. An eccentric rich guy shakes up the world with a big announcement at a press conference.
I'm just not the hero type, clearly, with this laundry list of character defects, all the mistakes I made, largely public. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Truth is, I am Iron Man.
Robert Downey Jr. is Tony Stark in the original Iron Man movie. That announcement ends the movie and begins one of the biggest pop culture franchises ever, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Spanning a few dozen-ish movies and counting, plus some TV series too, sort of, Marvel superheroes live in a shared universe and a developing plotline that's dominated pop culture, made tons of money, and influenced other creators. And our next guests say the Marvel Cinematic Universe is packed with political messages that reflect the culture of their time and can influence it in turn. They've edited a new book tracing some of those messages. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts about the political and social messages that you've seen in a superhero movie or show or a comic book? Or are you going to superhero stories to get away from all that stuff? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guests are the editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Nicholas Carnes is a professor of public policy at Duke University. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And Lily J. Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on today, Rob.
Lily, let's start with you. If we want to learn about our political world, why turn to pop culture?
I've long studied popular culture, and popular culture often reflects back the realities of our lived experiences in so many different kinds of messages and in so many different kinds of presentations and representations. And so while popular culture, be it televisual or cinematic or video games or music, are also forms of entertainment and capitalism. They also talk to us a lot about who we are and what we do.
Okay, Nick, why the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
Well, I focus on just the sheer scope of it. I mean, we're up to 30 films, 9 Disney Plus shows, and, you know, films are regularly making close to or more than $1 billion at the box office. So part of the appeal of studying this sort of entertainment franchise is just the sheer number of people watching it and thinking about it. And as a political scientist, that's a site where I really want to know, okay, what are the messages? What are the political messages it's sending?
And Lily, is there something inherent in a superhero story? You talk about this, I think it was in the introduction the two of you wrote to the book, that there are big problems that only amazing individuals can save us from.
Yeah, I mean, superheroes occupy a space that is one that is generally not, quote, democratically, small d, democratically elected. So they operate usually outside of a governmental system, which is can be somewhat problematic. And then we look to them to solve problems that we ourselves cannot get ourselves to solve with their superhero capacities. And that perhaps gives us, unfortunately, the out of never being able to solve other problems that we face on the regular basis, because we always want superheroes to solve those problems.
And Nick, looking at the different pieces in your book, the different Marvel movies, if we're going and looking for one political message, we might be in trouble. There's so much variety here. You and the authors of pieces in your book, it seems like they found a pretty wide variety of messages, sometimes even conflicting with each other.
That's right. And that's why this volume is sort of drawing on more than 30 political scientists' expertise on a wide range of topics, because when you have so many films with so many different creative teams, there's actually a lot of variety, and there's no one sort of single message that I think is coming out of this cinematic franchise. So we really needed, I mean, when Lily and I sort of started working on this project, I think we realized really early on it had to be a big team effort to even, you know, sort of scratch the surface at understanding of, you know, what's going on in this huge amount of cinema and pop culture text.
We're talking to political scientist Nicholas Carnes and Lily Gorin, co-editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see political or social messages coming through? Do you think they're on purpose or accidental? Do you like those messages when you're going to see that big Marvel blockbuster or the TV show? Or if you're reading the comics, the book doesn't go there, but you can. 800-642-1234 is the number. Jake joins us now in Appleton. Jake, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just want to say that I'll argue that I don't believe there's political messaging in this, simply because I don't believe political messaging is a big draw for movie and theater appreciation, or just people who enjoy cinema. And I'm sure we could look at older movies like The Wizard of Oz and things like A Lion King and probably find similarities to political messaging, simply because the last 5-6 years has been extremely deep in like exposure, like I more in my lifetime than I remember. So that's my comment on it.
Jake, thanks for the call. And Lily, maybe we're going to these movies for escapism. If there are political messages in there, they just kind of wash over us because we're there for the story of the special effects.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that we're not necessarily talking about a writing team or a directing or producing team that sits down and say, we want to communicate this particular right. message. But messages are communicated. And there are lots of different kinds of messages that are communicated about race, about gender, about sexuality, about power, about governmental structures, about the military. And so, again, it's not necessarily that there is a finely crafted message that is the narrative, but the narrative does communicate a variety of political messages.
Jake, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I wanted to get into some for instances and check out the chapters each of you contributed to this book. Nick, let's start with yours. You tackled the U.S. government appears a lot in these movies and TV shows. You tackled, are they portrayed positively or negatively? How'd you do that briefly? What did you find?
So one of the things I was interested in when we first started thinking about the MCU and what sort of the subtle political messages might be is when the U.S. government is on screen, is it a good guy or a bad guy, right? So there's this idea that Lily referred to, that, you know, superheroes kind of solve the problems that governments can't. It wouldn't be a very interesting movie if, you know, a villain showed up and, you know, Congress passed a law and solved it. That might not be what people are looking for when they want to go see a blockbuster. So then the question is, well, okay, so what is government's function in here? Is it sort of a hapless, you know, we can't do anything and the heroes come and save us? Is it potentially an adversary? Is it corrupt? Is it, you know, working against the heroes? And so I worked with a couple of research assistants to actually code every single instance when the U.S. government is represented on screen in all the MCU films in phases 1 through 3, so the first 23, 24 films. And what we found is actually more often than not, government is on the side of the good guys. It's not helpless. It's not evil. More often than not, government is there and working with the heroes. So that's what we mean when we talk about the sort of subtle political messages that we find in these, you know, there's never sort of a scene where, you know, a hero saying, oh, government is good or government is bad. But in the background, we're seeing government operate. And I wanted to know, you know, what's the message people are taking away?
And then, Lily, you looked at the role of nostalgia in the Marvel Cinematic Universe versus, you know, the way it's used in the political world now. What kind of things are you looking at?
Well, I was looking at the way that movies themselves are entities that are structured nostalgically. Your experience going to the movie often takes you to a different place that can make you yearn for a different time or experience. And so I was looking at the MCU broadly in terms of what is being presented in this way that would make somebody yearn for another time or a different construction of our current situation. And I found that there is a connection between both nationalism, particularly U.S. nationalism, and a kind of nostalgic yearning for heroics from times gone by. And, you know, Captain America is kind of obviously an embodiment of this because his life spans 100 years or more. But you also see this in some of the other franchises, like in WandaVision, where nostalgic sort of tempos are integrated into the entire series by presenting it as different sort of decades of sitcoms. And so you have a lot of woven into the MCU, a structural nostalgia. And I wanted to sort of think about that and understand that in terms of this whole cinematic universe. Is it just Captain America, or is there more than Captain America in terms of that sort of understanding?
We're talking about big screen superheroes and some of the political and social messages they may send, with the editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University. Nicholas Carnes, professor of public policy at Duke University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or questions about political messages, social messages that might show up in superhero pop culture, whether it's on the big screen or small screen or the small page? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Lily Gorin and Nicholas Carnes, political scientist and editors of the new book called The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you followed some or all of these movies and TV shows in that Marvel world? Do you see political themes and messages in any superhero stories, print or screen? Do you like those messages? Do they bother you? A little of both sometimes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Waupun. Michael, hi.
Hi. Enjoying the conversation here. Many years ago, I was able to meet Stan Lee at a comic book convention. I brought my Silver Surfer comic, and he paused, and he looked at it, and he said, "Ah, Silver Surfer, he was always my favorite." And as a little fanboy, as a kid, that just made my day. that, like, my favorite character was Stan Lee's favorite character.
What is it about Silver Surfer that you and maybe Stan Lee appreciated?
Well, he's a character that sacrificed himself in order to save the planet Earth from the character Galactus, and then he became kind of a herald for him, just kind of searching the universe, looking for planets for him to devour. And it kind of expresses our own humanity and our own, maybe, you know, Galactus couldn't understand why he would do that.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Lily, this is kind of contrary to my point I brought up earlier. We're waiting for the superhero to save us. This is a case, this is a character who hasn't appeared in the Marvel Cinematic Universe yet, I don't think. But a normal person who sacrifices himself with a huge ethical decision. Do you see in some ways superheroes being an inspiration for individual action in the political or social world?
Oh, I would say so. And of course, you do have a number of the MCU superheroes who are not, in fact, gifted with superpowers. Both Iron Man and also Black Widow are straight up human beings. They don't have special powers. And of course, Iron Man is a man in a can. And so he designed it and it does all kinds of stuff. But he is, you know, he is just a human being like the rest of us. And so I do think that there is a dimension, particularly of this understanding of what a hero is and who a hero is. And a couple of our authors really dig at that and sort of put it in context of, you know, how we might each be able to be heroes in particular ways. And what is it that makes a hero? You know, superheroes have these particular qualities and capacities, but the idea of a hero has much longer legs in a lot of ways.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Hope you still have that autograph. That's pretty cool. Nick, we've talked a lot about, I think, U.S. politics and your work looks at the U.S. government in the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. But and the two of you write about this in your introduction. These are movies where people are hoping to make money all over the world that can lead to some compromises. A location, for example, in a Doctor Strange movie gets changed from Tibet to Nepal to not offend the Chinese government. How much does the global audience, you think, affect the messages, the choices we see?
Well, I just want to say first, I still have goosebumps from Michael's description of his interaction with Stan Lee.
Yeah,
I'm
cool.
A comic book fan myself and a fan of the genre. So I'm still reeling from that anecdote. I think that's a great example of the moving Kamar-Taj, Doctor Strange's sort of trainings, where Doctor Strange is trained, moving that from Tibet, which it is in the comics, to Nepal, which it is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is a great example of Marvel Studios and Disney really trying to avoid political controversy. And, you know, our first caller said, you know, I don't see a lot of political messaging in here. I actually think that's not an accident. You know, Disney's trying to appeal to global audiences and to a broad audience here in the U.S. And so they're really trying to stay out of political fights. They you know, sometimes can't help themselves. You know, fans will pressure for, you know, Disney or Marvel Studios for more representation or for less representation. You know, they're going to be accused of being too woke or not progressive or not enough. And I think in this, you know, the sort of capitalist or the sort of market impulse that's driving, you know, a big corporation like Disney is always going to be avoid those controversies when you can. So I think you're going to see that not just internationally, but also in terms of the way they interact with domestic political debates.
Talking to Nick Carnes and Lily Gorin about the new book, they're co-editors of The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Lily, Nick just mentioned issues of representation. That occupies a good chunk of this book, different essays on how representation has changed over the years in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Can you talk about some of the things that the authors bring up?
Yeah, this is a really rich area of discussion in the book. All areas are excellent, but there were just a lot of different contributors who wanted to talk about different aspects of this question of representation. So there's questions of feminism, that are explored in a number of places. There's questions of disability and trauma that mm-hmm. is explored. There's this really fascinating chapter on how the Avengers are a kind of found family or built family. That was a really fascinating chapter when it first came across our desks and we started reading it. There are, of course, questions about masculinity, because that's so much of what is presented in symbolic ways throughout the MCU. There is a question of the MCU closet and who's still in it, and sort of lack of representation in certain regards with regard to the LGBTQ plus community. So all of these different areas are sort of represented in different chapters. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion with regard to race and understanding a place like Wakanda, which is a kind of Afro-futurist paradise, if you will, and you know how that sort of stacks up against our understanding of the Black lived experience. So there's all kinds of stuff in there in terms of these many, many, many properties, and you know what they are communicating in terms of character development and narrative and symbols and our understanding of ourselves.
Nick, as a comics fan and a political scientist, I imagine you must bring this into the classroom sometimes. How do you talk to your students about how to read a text like a superhero movie and start to look for these kind of messages?
Well, so I sort of take a lot of cues from the, you know, scholars like Lily, who, you know, really have deep expertise on popular culture. I try to convey to students something that I learned from Lily, actually, which is to think about politics not just as elections, campaigns, debates, speeches, but to see politics as, you know, questions about power, representation, and how we live our lives. And once you sort of take that broader perspective on politics, you start to better, you know, see the politics that does exist in popular culture texts like the MCU. And you also better understand why people so often have real world political debates about what occurs in fictional, you know, storytelling. You know, why people will say, I don't like this character being depicted this way. It's because that's really a site where politics is happening, even in fiction, even in superhero stories. So I try to convey that to my students.
Just a few moments left. I'm going to put each of you on the spot and ask for a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie recommendation if somebody's going to see just one. Lily, you get to go first.
Thor Ragnarok.
Okay, easy. Quick line on why.
Because it's hysterically funny, and it really is an interesting exploration of, you know, sort of superheroics. And there are a variety of different sort of nods towards gender and race as well.
And Nick?
I'd have to go with Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 1 or 2.
Excellent. That is all the time we have. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, thanks again.
Been talking to Nicholas Carnes, professor of public policy at Duke University, and Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. They're the co-editors of the book we've been talking about. It's called The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They both had a quick pick. I like that. No hemming and hawing. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.